From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, pornography's profitable new frontier, the home. We talk with Eric Schlosser. His report on the business of pornography is the cover story of the February 10th U.S. News & World Report. Also, Dying Well, we talk with Dr. Ira Byock about helping patients die at home with the help of a hospice. He's the president of the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Fountains of Wayne, the new album by the band of the same name. One of the band's members wrote the title song, That Thing You Do, for Tom Hanks' recent film. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The tobacco industry is making its case in a federal court in North Carolina at this hour against new government regulations that are set to take effect at the end of this month. NPR's Adam Hochberg reports.
The proposed regulations on tobacco products are designed to keep teenagers from smoking, and they're scheduled to start taking effect at the end of the month. They would require store clerks to check photo IDs of people who want to buy cigarettes, would limit tobacco advertising, and would ban the industry from sponsoring sporting events. Tobacco companies say the new regulations violate the First Amendment, and they say the FDA is overstepping its authority by regulating cigarettes, a product they claim is neither a food nor a drug. Only Congress, they say, can legally impose restrictions on tobacco. FDA Commissioner David Kessler is among those in the crowded courtroom in Greensboro, North Carolina today. Kessler has said that the FDA does have jurisdiction to regulate tobacco because he considers nicotine an addictive drug. I'm Adam Hochberg reporting.
American Airlines and its pilots union are set to begin talks this afternoon in Washington, D.C. before the National Mediation Board in an attempt to head off a strike that could disrupt air traffic in this country by the weekend. The two sides have only 5 days to reach agreement, or the 9,300 pilots with the nation's largest air carrier promise to walk out, grounding the airline during the busy President's Day weekend. The pilots are seeking raises of about 11% spread over the next 4 years. A group of Croats opened fire on Muslims visiting a cemetery today in the divided Bosnian town of Mostar. At least 4 people were wounded. Karen Coleman reports from Sarajevo.
According to UN spokesman Alex Ivanko, a group of Muslims went to the west side of Mostar, dominated by the Croats, to visit a grave site earlier today. Initial reports say a group of Croats there started stoning them. Then, according to Mr. Ivanko, the Croats opened fire on the Muslims. But another crowd of people has been gathering outside the city's main hotel in the west side. International personnel working in the city have offices there. Captain Mike Fabro from the multinational force S4 says the crowd's around 100. Captain Fabro says the situation's under control and that the Spanish division of S4 responsible for the region has cordoned off the area. Recently, patrols have been stepped up in Mostar after a spate of explosions raised tensions between the rival Muslim and Croat communities. For National Public Radio, I'm Karen Coleman in Sarajevo.
Italy's highest court has decided that a military court should hear the war crimes retrial of former Nazi SS Captain Erich Priebke. He's accused of complicity in multiple murder for his role in a Nazi massacre of more than 300 boys and men near Rome during World War II. At Wall Street on this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 4 points at 6,852 in active trading. On the Nasdaq, the composite index is down about 10. This is NPR. Now in NPR's business update, the dollar was bid higher in European trading today after sliding quite sharply in the Far East in the wake of Saturday's Group of Seven meeting. Many financial analysts see the greenback's recent strengthening trend continuing for the next several weeks. President Clinton's message to the Federal Reserve appears to be relax in an economic report to Congress today. Mr. Clinton says inflation and unemployment have been low since 1994, and that trend should continue at least a few more years. Westinghouse Electric is adding another broadcast property to its current list as it transforms itself from a manufacturing company to a media giant. Bloomberg's Chris Graham has more details.
Westinghouse Electric caught on the heels of its $5.4 billion buyout of CBS in 1995. The $5 billion purchase of Infinity Broadcasting last year is growing again. This time, $1.5 billion in stock to buy the Nashville Network. And Country Music Television from Gaylord Entertainment of Nashville, a deal that makes sense to Smith Barney analyst John Reedy.
The importance is to have a place on the cable dial in addition to your network station. And also, these are businesses where you could make changes, do other things with.
Westinghouse officially changes its name to CBS later this year after it spins off its industrial operations to shareholders. Chris Graham, Chicago.
The nation's number two toy company, Hasbro, is buying Odds On Products, which manufactures those squishy Kush balls. Hasbro is paying $166 million to acquire the firm, as well as Cap Toys, a maker of dolls, novelty toys, and battery-operated candy products, including an automated Pez dispenser. The deal is expected to be completed by summer. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, for reporting on disadvantaged youth and families, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Fresh Air support comes from William Morrow, publishers of Even the Wicked, the new Matthew Scudder mystery novel by Lawrence Block.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Pornography has moved from the underground into the mainstream. According to U.S. News and World Report, last year Americans spent more than $8 billion on hardcore videos, peep shows, live sex acts, adult cable programming, sexual devices, computer porn, and sex magazines. That's larger than Hollywood's domestic box office receipts and larger than all the revenues generated by rock and country music recordings. And you'd be surprised at some of the corporations which are making big profits from pornography. My guest Eric Schlosser followed the money for his report on the business of porn, the cover story of the February 10th issue of U.S. News. I asked him why he wanted to write about the business side of porn.
Well, someone had told me that about 20% of all the video rentals in the United States were hardcore porn. And that really surprised me, given that the size of the video market in the United States is about $16 billion. And everyone has heard of companies like 20th Century Fox and Warner Brothers, but I didn't know anything about where all this money was going, and I knew that it had to be billions of dollars, but I really had never read anything that said, where is this money going? So I decided to do a piece that would try to follow the money and see how this business operates and who's profiting from it.
As you point out in your cover story in U.S. News and World Report, the whole nature of the pornography industry has changed. It's moved from the movie house and from the adult bookstore into the home.
Mm-hmm.
And what is behind that move?
Well, a couple of things. The first is technology. And what's really fueled the boom in pornography over the last 10, 15 years is the video cassette, which has allowed people to watch in their own homes the type of material that they'd have to have gone to an adult theater or to an adult bookstore for 25 years ago. But it's not just a question of technology. It's also a cultural change in the sense that this material is considered permissible and it's now part of the mainstream, where during the 1980s, the Reagan and Bush administrations tried very hard to clamp down on pornography. And it launched one of the largest assaults on the porn industry in the nation's history. It failed, and one of the reasons it failed is that juries throughout the country were often unwilling to convict people for selling hardcore porn. Even in some very conservative communities where the Reagan and Bush administrations deliberately pressed charges. So it's a combination of the technology making it possible, but also enough of a change in American attitude so that people think it's acceptable to buy and sell this material.
I was really surprised to learn that it's mostly mom-and-pop video stores that are selling pornography.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're renting it, and they're also selling it. It's part of the technological change, but it also has to do with the market in the sense that some of the major video chains, such as Blockbuster, won't carry X-rated material. And as Blockbuster and the big chain stores have taken over a larger part of the market, the independent retailers who want to stay in business had to find something that they could offer that the chains didn't, and it was hardcore porn. In addition to that, it's an incredible source of revenue for them. So even though it may not occupy a large part of their stores, in terms of their revenues, it can be anywhere from 10, 20, up to 50% at some ordinary-looking video stores in communities throughout the country.
Is the profit margin bigger on pornographic video than on your basic Hollywood release?
The profit margin is much bigger because whereas a mainstream Hollywood release might cost anywhere from $60 to $90 for the video retailer, a porn video might be $15 or $20, and whereas a Hollywood film may rent for $3, a hardcore film rents for $4, so they can make back their original investment after four or five rentals of the video.
Now, in your attempt to follow the money in the pornography business, you met the leading director of pornography videos, John Stagliano?
John Stagliano, yes.
What's his claim to fame?
He began directing videos in the mid-'80s in which he used a handheld camera and made very inexpensive videos in a kind of cinema verite, pseudo-documentary style, and he has an enormous following as a result. And he has started his own company. He now distributes the work of other porn directors, and he's a self-made man, American, successful entrepreneur. And he's also very active with the Cato Institute in Washington. He has a degree in economics and wanted to become an economics professor. And he's, again, a real American character.
Now, there's not only a lot of pornography videos being made with actors. There's a big market for amateur porn video, homemade stuff where you set up a camera and basically shoot yourself, I suppose, or shoot your friends. What's that market like?
Well, that's anywhere from a third to a quarter of the market now. And the introduction of camcorders in the 80s gave people the opportunity to use them to film whatever they liked. And people quickly began using it to film themselves having sex, started exchanging the tapes, and it became a business so that there are companies now that sell nothing but amateur tapes. And whereas most of this industry is based in Southern California, these amateur companies are throughout the country in very unlikely locales. And it's really, to me, it's a sign of how deeply embedded this material now is in our culture, because these are ordinary people almost getting away from the middleman and making films of themselves and selling them directly to other people. And it's the thing that was really mind-boggling to me was to realize how central a component of American popular culture this material now is.
Who's making the profit with the amateur porn videos?
Well, it depends. I mean, there are some people who are just filming themselves and sending it off to these companies, and they get paid something like $20 for each minute of film that's used. And so in that case, the money is going straight to the distributor. But in some cases, people have set up their own amateur companies, and they're profiting from it. And then, of course, the video retailer who's renting it makes the most profit. Most of the profits from the video trade and hardcore porn is not going to the porn companies in Southern California. It's going to the video retailers throughout this country.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Eric Schlosser, and he wrote the cover story in the February 10th edition of U.S. News and World Report called The Business of Porn. Now, we think of the porn industry as being in a shadow world tied to crime, and of course, some of it, or perhaps much of it is, but there's also a lot of big mainstream companies who are making profits from pornography. And you point out, for example, that many chain hotels have that pay-per-view softcore video available in every room, and they're making a lot of money from it.
Yeah, most of the hotel chains do. I think I can't even think of one offhand that has refused to run them. And the way that they've subsidized the porn industry is these films are produced by the porn companies in Los Angeles and then slightly re-edited for the hotels. They're sold in the hotel rooms, and the hotels get a cut of up to 20% for the purchase of each one of these films. Similarly, the cable companies are running these films that are re-edited for cable, and the cable companies get a cut of up to 70%, in some cases 80% of the revenues generated from these films. So again, material that would only have been available in a gray market or a black market 25, 30 years ago is now being sold by companies that are in the Fortune 500. And again, I think it really reflects a lot of the changes in American society that these companies are willing to do this.
Now, what about phone sex? Are phone companies making money from phone sex?
Domestic phone companies are making an enormous amount of money from phone sex. One of the major means of distribution for phone sex now is through long-distance calls. The phone sex companies set up systems where they have, quote, actresses, unquote, in foreign countries. And when you call the foreign country, you talk to this person who's trying to keep you on the line as long as possible. And what they do is, for a long-distance call, the domestic carrier gets half of the cost of the call, and the foreign phone company gets half of the cost of the call, and these foreign phone companies are splitting their take with the phone sex companies. As a result, there is anywhere from $250 million to $500 million being spent on these long-distance phone sex calls each year, and domestic phone companies like AT&T, MCI, Sprint are getting a very large portion of that money. Now, they're not encouraging people to make long-distance phone sex calls, and they're not working directly with these phone sex operations, but they are profiting a great deal from this system of billing for phone sex.
Why do you have to call another country now for phone sex?
Well, there was legislation passed a few years ago that limited the type of communications that you could make with these 900 numbers, which had been the previous way for doing a lot of phone sex. And because of the limits on the kind of content and the limits on the obscene speech for 900 phone calls, this is a way to drive up a large bill and get a cut of it. And that's what the phone sex companies are trying to do, is to keep people on the line as long as possible and to charge a lot of money for it. The other way that they're doing it is through credit card calls and taking your credit card number and then charging you per minute.
Now, how upfront are cable companies, phone companies, hotel chains about the amount of profits that they're making from pornographic-related material? I mean, do they mention that in their end-of-the-year statements to their shareholders?
No, and I don't think it's something that they are widely advertising. In the case of the cable companies, the cable companies have deliberately been very discreet about their adult film sales and have found that they don't really need to advertise them. And that's another benefit that they've found. People find these channels without having to be encouraged to find them. And it's something that I think that they're not boasting about. At the same time, in their defense, they are simply providing a service that there is an enormous demand for. I mean, this industry is not driven by a small group of pornographers or a small group of corporations that's trying to foist this on the American people. There is just a phenomenal demand for this material. I mean, according to Adult Video News, which is an industry trade publication, last year there were 665 million hardcore video rentals in the United States, and that works out to a few hardcore videos for every adult in the country. So there's an enormous demand for it.
It's a very impressive number.
Yeah, it's a very large number. And whether it's true or not, it may be less than that. There's no doubt that it's an extraordinary figure. And it's a figure, according to Adult Video News, in 1985, when the Mies Commission was appointed, there were 75 million adult video rentals. So we've gone from 75 million to 665 million in the last decade.
My guest is Eric Schlosser, and we're talking about the story he wrote called The Business of Porn, which is the cover story for the February 10th issue of U.S. News & World Report. We'll talk more about the business after we take a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the business of pornography, the cover story of the February 10th edition of U.S. News & World Report. My guest is the author, Eric Schlosser. Well, you've been following the money in pornography. What's happening on the Internet now?
Well, the Internet is the great hope of people in this industry. it has the advantage of offering a kind of anonymity of purchase, which really helps this business, and a great diversity of potential choices, like in the video store. But they haven't quite figured out how to make money off of it, like most companies haven't figured out how to make money off of it. Two of the problems and two of the great impediments are the Communications Decency Act and the federal and state obscenity laws. And ideally, these companies would hope to make an enormous amount of money off of hardcore porn through the Internet. Right now, they're not. Right now, they're just starting to figure out how it all will work.
Well, you say that the Playboy website has millions of hits a day. Are they not charging the people on that website?
Right now, they're not charging people, but they are, according to their figures, getting 5 million hits a day. Now, that's not necessarily 5 million people visiting it, because each individual may be making more than one hit, but it's a lot of people at that website.
What are some of the predictions about pornography and the Internet in the future?
Well, Larry Flint believes that that's where it's all headed, and that you will be able to sit in your room with your remote control and surf the web and order any kind of hardcore material you would ever dream of having. And that's what he is hoping will happen, and he would like to be the person to help make it happen by helping to overturn the obscenity statutes.
In doing your research on the business of pornography, you came across a figure who you think is even more pivotal in the development of pornography than Larry Flint or Hugh Hefner. His name is Reuben Sturman, and he's in prison now on
yes.
tax evasion charges. But what's his significance in the development of the modern pornography business?
Well, he really was, for the modern pornography business, the Bill Gates or the John D. Rockefeller, the central figure who kind of established the basic distribution system and controlled this industry, or dominated this industry, in a way that few Americans have dominated an entire industry in this century. He's quite a character. He was from Cleveland, Ohio. Many of the major pornographers in this country are from the Midwest, which I find interesting. Hefner was from Illinois. Flint was from Kentucky and then Ohio, and Reuben Sturman was from Ohio. Sturman started out his career distributing comic books. And he drove around the neighborhoods of Cleveland in his old Dodge in the early 1950s, selling comic books from the trunk of his car. He started, through that work, a magazine distribution company that eventually had warehouses throughout the Midwest. As a result, when the sexual content of magazines became more popular, he had a distribution system in place. And whereas many people were unwilling to distribute this material, he couldn't care less. He wasn't obsessed with sex, but he figured it sold, he'd sell it. So pretty soon, by the end of the 1950s, he had a large-scale distribution system for sex magazines in this country. And from that basis, he gained control of the wholesale distribution of sex magazines, eventually sex films and sex videos in this country. And really, until the 1980s, he dominated this industry, not only in the United States, but also throughout most of the world. He used the profits from his American operations, and particularly from his peep booths. He is credited with inventing the peep booth, and invested in porn companies in England, in Germany, in Switzerland, in Holland, and he dominated the sale of sexual material throughout the world. And his downfall was precipitated by a worldwide effort by law enforcement agencies, not just in the United States, but in the United Kingdom, in Switzerland, throughout Europe. They all wanted to bring this man down.
I guess they succeeded. He's in federal prison now. What would you say is his legacy? How much of the porn industry is built in his image?
Well, his legacy is twofold. His legacy is in setting up the system that really allowed this business to become entrenched and to thrive. His legacy is also, in some ways, like Flint in the area of free speech and First Amendment rights. One of the reasons he was so successful is he battled the government, the federal government, with all of his resources and won one obscenity trial after another. He was indicted on six separate occasions on federal obscenity charges, and more than a dozen times on state and local obscenity charges, and he won every time. And as these victories reached the market, what it did is it strengthened the sexual content of the material that could be sold. What's interesting, and just to give a little perspective on it, Reuben Sturman's first obscenity charge under federal law was in 1964, I believe, for a book called Sex Life of a Cop. The book contained no dirty words, no photographs, no explicit description of sex, and he was indicted for obscenity. And in 1964 was the same year when Lenny Bruce was convicted for using dirty words in his nightclub act. The type of material that is now being distributed by mainstream cable companies legally is so much stronger than what the pornographers were being indicted for in the early 60s, and it really shows just the sea change in attitudes towards sexual content in this country. And it really was the pornographers who broadened the freedom of expression, for better or worse, according to how you feel, in this country, not the mainstream publishers and not the mainstream film companies.
The editor of U.S. News and World Report, James Fallows, has a little introduction to your piece on the business of pornography, and he says that after you met your first peep show operator, you were so depressed you almost quit the story. What was so depressing?
It was just as depressing a place as you could imagine in New York's Times Square, and it was grim beyond belief. And I left there and thought to myself, what am I doing? And that may have been when I went into the library and really tried to understand the history of this industry and realized that this is our popular culture, for better or for worse. More people are watching the films of John Stagliano than are familiar with Arthur Miller or Tennessee Williams at this point. And people aren't acknowledging that fact. This is a major component of American popular culture. It didn't seem to me there was a history that had been written or really a sense of how it operates, and that's what encouraged me to return to the story.
Eric Schlosser, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Eric Schlosser wrote The Business of Porn, the cover story of the February 10th issue of U.S. News and World Report. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Dr. Ira Byock about helping people die in comfort at home. Byock is president of the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Fountains of Wayne by the band of the same name. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Through his years as a hospice doctor, Ira Byock has learned that dying doesn't have to be agonizing. Byock is the president of the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine and directs the Palliative Care Service at the Partners Hospice in Missoula, Montana. He helps people who are dying with their physical pain and also tries to create an environment that eases mental anguish. He writes about the at-home deaths of several of his patients in his new book, Dying Well. He also writes about convincing his terminally ill father to leave the hospital and spend his last few days at Byock's house, surrounded by family. Byock says that dying in the hospital can be a macabre experience.
It's still seen as an unnatural event in a hospital. Hospitals are directed at keeping people alive. Hospitals are palaces of technical expertise, wonderful technical expertise, designed to correct physiologic abnormalities and to preserve life. So again, dying in a hospital is an awkward thing to do, and when it occurs, it always seems to be somewhat of a shock. It's like out of context. So often, particularly in teaching hospitals, and particularly, I don't know that the situation is a great deal better today, but I'm hopeful that it's at least a little bit better. When I was training, however, you could not die in a hospital without having a full court press to keep somebody alive. So very often, even people with end-stage heart disease or liver disease or cancer would be subjected to obviously futile attempts to restart their heart. It was done mostly for dramatic purposes. We all knew that it was futile, but we had to be able to say to the system, if you will, that everything was done to keep this person alive.
Have you thought a lot about how it affects somebody's death to have that kind of intrusive medical procedure done at the moment of dying?
Well, you know, I do think that it is undignified, that we are treating people in an undignified manner when they are obviously just moments away from dying or in a sense have already died, and we are still acting as if that's not permissible, as if somehow this very human fact of their mortality is unacceptable to us. So in that regard, it doesn't feel right to me. I look at that transition, that transitus from life to whatever comes next, as a time when people deserve to be honored, loved, even celebrated in this passing. And I think medicine has an important role to play in that. Clearly, that sort of care, which we try to teach and we try here to model in the care that we offer to our patients and families, that kind of care requires more than medicine, but medicine has an important role to play. In so doing, it must really accept the inherent dignity of the human condition, including the inherent inevitable fact of our dying.
You specialize in palliative care, and you say that all pain is controllable. What are some of the latest techniques to control pain?
There are many. The control of pain begins by a careful assessment of what's causing the pain. You know, because somebody has a lung cancer that has perhaps spread to various parts of their body, when I get a call that person is in pain, the answer is not, well, more morphine or whatever, another drug. Initial response is, what's causing the pain? You know, what makes it better? What makes it worse? Where is it? What are the qualities of the pain? Is the pain today consistent with where the person had a metastatic lesion on a bone scan a few weeks ago, or is it another pain? Is it perhaps muscular pain that we might treat with a physical therapy modality? So analysis is the first step, and although you asked about advances, the advance here is that for so often when somebody has had a terminal illness and is in pain, it has always been assumed, I think, that, well, it's just their cancer again. That is fraught with problems. So firstly, our most important therapeutic tool is the same sort of analytic process that doctors go through all the time in so much of the work that we do. There are medications to be used. Morphine and like opioid medications often have an important role to play. Additionally, we're using radiation therapy in very short fractions, meaning one or two doses, to control bone pain if somebody has cancer that is approachable in that manner. We are using local injection blocks of anesthetics to control pain at times. We're using steroid medications. There is so much that is being developed as far as our pain-reducing protocols. I feel that we are well-resourced at the present time. The real challenge is into bringing this together and really applying it to the goal of alleviating all physical pain.
Everybody has a different threshold for pain. Do you trust people's subjectivity? If somebody says that they're in terrible pain, and to you that might be, you know, pretty minor pain, will you still treat them as if it is terrible pain?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Pain is a subjective phenomenon. A patient's pain is as bad as they tell you it is. Now, in saying that, we don't let people write their own prescriptions. We have a responsibility as professionals who do this work to assess the causes of pain, its various contributions, and to hopefully construct an approach to that patient's discomfort that requires more than just a prescription. So, for instance, if somebody isn't sleeping well, their pain will rise. We know, and it's not a subtle fact of physiology, that sleep deprivation, simply being very tired, decreases one's threshold and makes people experience pain as more severe. So we might change things, whether it's a prescription for a sleeping medication or simply changing the person's bed or the schedule in the home to facilitate their sleep. Similarly, with emotional stress, you know, if there is stress in a marital relationship or a relationship between a person and their child or some other significant other, that will increase their subjective experience of pain. That doesn't make the pain less real, but it certainly changes the way we respond.
A lot of families are dispersed around the country, and I'm sure you've treated a lot of dying people who have adult children who live on the opposite coast, or you know, hundreds or thousands of miles away, and they can't be together during the long process of dying. If in fact that process is a long process, they can't be together for all of that time. What advice do you give families about the dying process when it involves long distance relationships?
Oh. That's an excellent question, mainly to stay involved, to express your caring and your love, to think about visiting early. Because the quality of visiting can be good. There are more things that one can do when before the illness has progressed to a point where somebody is bedbound or doesn't have the strength to really interact as they otherwise would. So I really encourage people to plan their visits early, to think about what would be left undone if the person were to die today. And think about not only just the fiscal and legal sorts of things that come to mind, but beyond that, what's left undone in this relationship? What would you want the person to know? What would you want to say to that person? I think it's important to realize that this is a high priority in the life of families, that, you know, we all die. You know, death is inevitable, and dying is a part of the life of every individual, but dying is also part of the life of every family. And it is not simply a stressor, but an opportunity for the family that will live on to grow through this experience.
Your father died at your house, but he was sick for months, and you lived pretty far away from him during most of that time. What were some of the things you felt you were able to do from a long distance?
Well, you know, I was a doctor even then, and so I could provide some answers to questions that came up. I could provide some suggestions of other resources that they might be able to find in the community in which they lived. I did some calling myself to try to find out more information from doctors or the local hospice program there. It was hard, though, Terry. You know, it's hard to be separate from somebody that you love, who you know is ill and really dealing with symptoms and a serious illness and the emotional strain of this illness.
Dr. Ira Byock is my guest, and he's the president of the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine, and he's medical director at a hospice in Missoula, Montana, and the author of the new book, Dying Well. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dr. Ira Byock, author of the new book, Dying Well. He's the president of the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine. I think one of the biggest fears of people who are dying is about losing their dignity, especially if they have an illness or a condition that leaves them incontinent. What do you tell people when they say to you, doctor, this is really embarrassing for me, I'm losing my dignity?
Well, I don't say anything right away. I listen, because how could it be otherwise, in a sense? People do feel an inherent sense of embarrassment about having somebody else toilet them and engage in intimate hygiene and the like. I tell them, however, what my feeling is as somebody who cares for them, and that is that, firstly, it's no big deal. It's just part of what we do, and the nurses with whom I work say the same thing. This is just part of caring for people. My other perspective is that they're just human beings, and that at the end of life, we tend to be frail and fragile and physically dependent and in need of care. And that's not inherently undignified. You know, I don't think that people who are physically dependent in that regard are any more undignified than would be an infant or a toddler in such circumstances. What happens when you have those sorts of discussions and sort of explain to people that from our perspective, they're doing what they need to do right now simply by allowing themselves to be cared for by those of us professionals and volunteers who feel drawn to doing this work, by explaining that, people often simply relax and realize that what we're saying has some truth to it.
Do a lot of your patients say to you, doctor, why are you drawn to doing this work?
It gets asked, and you know, I don't have an easy answer for them. It's very satisfying work. For me, it seems natural. People ask hospice people, how can you do this work? The real answer is, from our perspective, how could it be otherwise? How could we not do this work? This is the most exciting clinical work that I've ever done, and as you know, since you've read the book, I've worked in various clinical settings, including 14 years in an emergency department. That's also very satisfying, but it doesn't compare, in my experience, to the opportunity to witness and support people in this just inherently valuable, extraordinary time of life.
I wonder if you think it's wise to try to protect children from death and try to keep them away from the hospice or the hospital or the cemetery.
I think it's an unwise decision. It reinforces this sense that there's something unseemly going on with grandma, or sometimes even with their parents, with mom or dad, because they're ill. You know, there's enough pain around dying without having to hide it and give children the sense that we're ashamed about it. And that's what they understand. We may think we're protecting them from the emotions, but in a sense, we're really protecting ourselves. And we're giving them the impression, since we're, you know, ushering them out of the room and talking in hushed tones, that there's something unseemly or embarrassing happening behind closed doors. I think just the opposite approach is helpful. Allowing children to know in terms that they can understand what's happening here, that their loved one is very sick and likely not going to get better and will probably die. And then allowing them to see our pain, to see that how people honor one another by shedding tears and by being sad, by changing our schedules and doing whatever we can do to be present and helpful. In that way, while children will share our sadness, they will also, I think, develop a healthy model for how human beings care for one another at the end of life.
What are the typical visits from your hospice like? If there is such a thing as a typical visit.
I think every visit's unique, but our program does function under a team model. Often the person visiting is the primary case manager nurse who's assigned to the patient. We often also send in nurses' aides or bath aides to help with patients' hygiene. They may be visited by a social worker or the chaplain, and I'm around to help as a consult to the team as well as to the patient's primary physician. I don't know that there's a typical visit. We tend to act in concert. The nurse and myself often begin by focusing on physical symptoms, but we also are, I think, all of us attentive to the interpersonal aspects of the person's experience with illness and the family's experience with illness, and also to the inherent transcendent or existential issues that come up in people's minds.
You know, it's funny, so much of the healthcare system has gotten away from, you know, the doctor home visit. When I was growing up, pediatrician always used to come to the house, but it's coming back for people who are discharged from the hospital and have nurses visiting at home. It's coming back in the hospice movement.
It certainly is. I find that I learned so much more in the home than I am able to in the hospital. I was trained to work in hospitals, and initially home visits were very foreign to me. And in my years in the emergency department, I certainly appreciated seeing patients there. The chart was ready. I had all the patient's vital signs already recorded for me, and I've got all these wonderful tools and bells and whistles at my disposal. However, now I feel just the opposite. In the home, I can get a sense not only of the patient's symptoms, but also of how they are functioning through their day and their activities of daily living, how they're, you know, where the bathroom is in relation to their bedroom, where their bed is, and, you know, is that in an optimal place for them? All those sorts of things, as well as get a sense of their relationships with the people around them, their spouse and family, but also the people who may come and go in their immediate environment. Perhaps if it's a duplex, the people who live next door, or, you know, the people from down the street. That, all of that, that whole total picture provides me with so much more information that enables me to make more intelligent and hopefully helpful suggestions and changes in their plan of care.
Do you find that most people who need home hospice care can qualify for it in their health insurance?
Frankly, not. I think, we are trying to cut back on the funding for intensive home care in addition, at the same time that we're trying to get people out of the hospital sooner and more intensive home care is needed. So, you know, we're trying to cut costs on both ends, and in the middle, patients and families get pinched. So often nowadays, we're having to defend the eligibility for comprehensive services that hospice represents to third-party payers. You know, I've practiced in England for a while. I did some hospice work there to learn about how their system works. And I want you to know that although most of the experiences and stresses of dying are universal and part of the human condition, some of the the system stresses and the financial worries, the sense of being a financial burden that I hear so often from patients and families, is a particularly American phenomenon. It does not need to be. We know we have enough resources in this country to provide comprehensive pain management and supportive care to patients and families without pauperizing them in the process.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Dr. Ira Byock is the author of Dying Well. He's the president of the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine. Coming up, Fountains of Wayne and That Thing They Do. This is Fresh Air. Think of Ken Tucker as your rock and roll newsman. He looks around and takes stock of what's in and what's out at this moment in rock and roll. Here's his report on a band he's hoping will become at least a part of the next big thing, Fountains of Wayne.
If you don't keep track of pop trends, I'll give you a quick update. Alternative rock is dead. All those poker-faced guys in plaid shirts have had their day, if the slow sales for latest releases by Pearl Jam and Nirvana's live album are any indication. Plus, the media is getting tired of these sullen fellows. Remember when you used to be able to count on rock stars to be cheerful and cheeky? So if dour self-importance is out, what's in? Techno and trip-hop music. That's the stuff that doesn't use rock and roll guitars, does use lots of keyboards, and finds its most visible media faces in acts like Tricky, The Prodigy, and The Chemical Brothers. But I'm also pleased to report that there's yet another boom market starting to flourish anew. Good old power pop, guitar-driven, hooky songs like those made by Fountains of Wayne. Getting lots of airplay and MTV screen space is this very nice little song, Radiation Vibe.
Are you alone now? Did you lose the monkey? He gave you black haze, and now you slouch. He didn't mean it.
Fountains of Wayne consists of two guys, Adam Schlesinger and Chris Collingwood. They met 10 years ago at Williams College in Massachusetts. Until now, Schlesinger was best known as the guy who wrote the Beatlesque title tune for last year's Tom Hanks movie, That Thing You Do, which itself became a hit single for the movie's fictional band, The Wonders. The Beatles and the British invasion in general are certainly influences on Fountains of Wayne, as are cult American acts like Big Star and Walter Egan. That Thing You Do was good, but even better is a more emotionally ambivalent Fountains of Wayne song like I've Got a Flair.
I got a flair for pulling your hair, making you crazy. Oh yeah, oh yeah, it's something I do well. I got a flair for making you care. You know you should hate me. Oh yeah, oh yeah, it's something I do well.
I love the way the guitar and keyboards chime along with the high, yearning vocal on that song. Adam Schlesinger is a busy guy. He's got another band that he leads called Ivy. He's just started his own record label with a member of Smashing Pumpkins called Scratchy Records. Schlesinger and Collingwood have hooked up with a drummer and another guitarist so that Fountains of Wayne can hit the road as a live act. I'm planning not to miss these guys.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Don't you want to ride in my survival car? We can take the long way home through Central Park. Funny how the ground can find my wheels. I'm going where the road ain't there. Riding on the path we made to Union Square. Doing what the young folks do in West Coast towns. Plowing like a banshee crew the overground. Funny how the ground can find my wheels. I'm going where the road won't tear. My calling. Everybody turn around. The light's about to change. You better stand aside. Why you wanna walk? Don't you wanna ride, ride, ride?
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.